You know that feeling, I mean, that creeping, ice-cold dread in the pit of your stomach when you realize the incredibly expensive, highly touted custom software your company just bought is, well, it's actually an absolute operational nightmare.
Oh, yeah, it's the worst.
Right. You're just sitting there staring at your screen. The vendor who sold you the dream is suddenly very hard to reach. Your team is complaining loudly in the Slack channels.
Yeah.
And you're just wondering, how did we end up here again?
It is a universally painful professional experience. I mean, a leadership team starts out expecting this sleek, automated, streamlined future.
Yeah.
And instead, they just find themselves tangled in a mess of broken workflows and missing data. It's like the promise of technology often collides violently with the reality of operations, you know?
Which is the exact pain point we are tackling in today's deep dive. We are unpacking a highly specific, very practical guide created by Technegian, and it's titled Custom Software Budget Planning: What Mid-Market Companies Should Include in 2026.
It's a really timely piece.
It is. This material is specifically aimed at mid-market business leaders, with a major focus on Orange County and Southern California. But honestly, the operational lessons here, they're universal.
Absolutely.
So our mission today is to give you a foolproof step-by-step blueprint to slow down your technology decisions, demand concrete evidence, and basically guarantee measurable success before you sign a single vendor contract.
Okay, let's unpack this. Why do we need this highly specific guide right now, specifically looking at the 2026 landscape?
Well, the business climate has shifted dramatically, and the margin for error has basically vanished. In 2026, mid-market companies are making these massive technology decisions under immense financial and operational pressure. I mean, budgets are significantly tighter across the board.
Yeah, everyone's feeling that squeeze.
Right. And the security expectations from clients and regulators, they're astronomical right now. So blindly trusting a software vendor to just figure it out as they go, it is no longer just a bad idea. It is a massive corporate liability.
Wow. Yeah, that makes sense. The guide really zeroes in on the underlying gap companies are feeling. Leaders are terrified of the operational risk. They are fed up with slow vendor response times. And they realize they've been relying on relationships built on, like, a friendly sales pitch rather than concrete, auditable processes.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second, though. Isn't looking at the software sort of the fun part of this whole ordeal?
I mean, sure, it can be.
Like, everyone wants to play with the shiny new tool. You sit through the sales demo, the analytics dashboard looks like a spaceship, the AI integrations sound like absolute magic. It's exciting to imagine your team actually using it.
The excitement is totally real, but falling for it is the ultimate trap. The guide specifically calls this the tool-first
A
decision.
tool-first decision.
Yeah, it happens when a leadership team falls in love with the solution before they fully understand their own internal problem.
It reminds me a lot of the restaurant business, actually. Buying custom software before defining your actual business outcome is it's like buying a massive $500,000 industrial pizza oven before you even know what kind of restaurant you're opening.
That is a perfect analogy.
Right. You're sitting there with this beautiful, incredibly expensive piece of machinery, and then your head chef walks in and says, "Hey, we're a sushi restaurant."
Right. And then what do you do?
Exactly. You start trying to make baked sushi just to justify the investment in the oven.
You're forcing the business to fit the tool. You end up bending your internal processes, frustrating your employees, and just compromising your service just to accommodate a piece of software that was, supposed to serve you in the first place.
It's totally backwards.
It really is.
Oh.
The source material is completely adamant on this point. Leaders must start with the outcome, not the software. Before you agree to a single demo, you have to define the specific business process that needs to improve. You have to identify the exact risk you're trying to reduce, or like the specific customer experience that must change.
And practically speaking, I guess that means doing the really unglamorous internal work first. You sit down and look at where the bottlenecks actually are.
Exactly. You have to get in the weeds.
Like, if your sales team is losing deals because they can't generate quotes fast enough, that is the outcome you need to solve, quote, generation speed. You don't just go buy a massive new CRM system just because it has a sleek interface.
Right, because that doesn't actually fix the root problem.
You figure out what metric will prove progress. If you can't name the metric, you have no business looking at software.
Reviewing your current systems, your messy data, your access rights, and your existing integrations, all of that is mandatory. You have to know your current state to even understand what a future state should look like.
So, assuming we've avoided the industrial pizza oven trap, We know what restaurant we're running, we've defined our required outcome, and now we are finally sitting across the table from a prospective vendor.
Right.
How do we actually evaluate their pitch without getting blinded by that shiny dashboard we talked about?
Mm.
The source material gives us this core framework, and it repeats four specific questions like a relentless mantra. I want to list them out for you because they are incredibly protective.
They really are the foundation of this whole approach.
Okay, so number one, what evidence supports the recommendation? Number two, who owns the outcome after launch?
That ownership piece is huge.
Totally. Number three, what risks should be handled before implementation? And number four, how will success be measured after 30, 60, and 90 days?
Asking those four questions, it completely flips the power dynamic of a sales pitch. It forces a transition from internal goal setting to rigorous external evaluation.
Because you're not just taking their word for it anymore.
Exactly. You are no longer just a passive audience member watching a demo. You are an auditor. And that feeds directly into what the guide calls the 2026 scorecard. Evaluating a vendor means scoring much more than just the software's features.
Right. It's way bigger than just the code.
A comprehensive scorecard has to weigh capability, absolutely, but it also mandates scoring their security protocols, their communication structure, their documentation habits, support models, scalability, and exit readiness.
Exit readiness is such a critical concept, and we'll definitely get to how you plan your escape route a bit later. But looking at the scorecard, the text issues a massive warning regarding cost transparency.
What's fascinating here is how strongly the source emphasizes that the lowest initial estimate is almost never the lowest total cost.
Never. It's always a trap.
It is a classic mirage that traps mid-market companies all the time. A vendor will present this incredibly low upfront implementation fee just to win the bid. But the scorecard forces you to look at the hidden mechanics of that bid.
Like what kind of mechanics?
Well, are there vague assumptions about scope changes? Are they charging exorbitant fees for basic maintenance? Does the long-term support contract automatically escalate every single year?
Oh, wow. Yeah, those add up fast.
A low initial bid with hidden long-term fees will absolutely destroy a budget over a three-year cycle.
So what does this all mean? It means you have to demand tangible evidence for every single claim. You don't just accept empty sales promises like, oh, our system integrates seamlessly with your current database.
Right. You make them prove it.
You say, great, show me the workflow diagrams. You ask for exact migration steps. Before you approve any work, you demand service level agreements or SLAs. And an SLA, I mean, it isn't just a promise to try really hard if the system goes down.
No, it's an actual contract.
It's a legally binding formula.
Yeah.
It means agreeing in writing that if the software is offline for 4 hours, the vendor owes you a specific financial penalty. It forces accountability.
Pushing for that level of detail, it really reveals a vendor's true competence. When you ask them to explain their discovery process or ask them what specific risks they expect to encounter with your data, pay very close attention to how they answer.
Because the good ones won't just brush it off.
Exactly. The strongest partners won't give you a generic, polished response. They will give you specific, sometimes uncomfortable answers. They will acknowledge the actual trade-offs.
Mm.
A truly mature vendor will actually suggest narrowing the scope of the project to ensure the first phase is successful before trying to, you know, boil the ocean.
Which naturally brings us to spotting the bad actors. Armed with this 2026 scorecard, how do we spot a terrible vendor before we ever sign a check? The text lists some pretty glaring red flags.
Some really scary ones, honestly.
Yeah, things like vague scopes of work where the deliverables aren't actually tied to dates, unclear access controls, hand-wavy answers to basic security questions. But the most terrifying red flag mentioned is the lack of a rollback plan.
Oh, a missing rollback plan is an automatic disqualifier. No exceptions.
Think about the mechanics of this for a second. Imagine a mid-market logistics firm. They install brand new routing software on a Friday night, fully expecting to be up and running by the weekend.
Which is a classic rollout strategy.
Right. But Monday morning rolls around, and the system completely crashes. None of the trucks can be dispatched. The executives are panicking, and they tell the vendor, turn it off, put the old system back online so we can at least function.
And this is where it gets bad.
And the vendor just shrugs and says,
ooh,
we can't. We overwrote the primary database during the install. Without a rollback plan, I mean, a literal snapshot of your system that lets you hit undo if things catch fire, you are in absolute free fall. You can lose millions of dollars in a matter of hours.
The rollback plan is your parachute. It really is. But alongside that, the ultimate litmus test the guide provides for evaluating a partner is their ability to explain the first 90 days of the relationship.
The 90-day plan.
Yeah. If a vendor cannot describe the first 90 days of the project in granular detail, they are simply not ready to touch your systems.
I want to push back on that timeline, though. Is 90 days really enough time to judge a massive, complex custom software rollout? Let's be real. In the corporate world, sometimes these massive operational shifts take a full year just to get off the ground and fully integrated.
That 12-month mindset is exactly what this framework is trying to dismantle.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The open-ended, year-long rollout with no intermediate checkpoints, it is corporate psychology at its absolute worst. It leads to budget bloat, massive scope creep, and just complete executive fatigue.
That does sound familiar.
The brilliance of the 90-day success plan is that it forces the project into strict, highly accountable sprints. It's not about finishing the entire build in 3 months.
Okay, that makes more sense.
It's about proving value and mitigating risk early on.
Ah, so it's a mechanism to stop the budget bleeding before it gets out of hand. If we look at how the guide breaks down those chunks, it's actually fascinating. Days 1 through 30 aren't even about building the software.
Not at all.
That first month is dedicated purely to mapping reality. The vendor and your team are getting in the trenches, looking at the messy, unstructured data you actually have, rather than the perfectly clean data you wish you had. You clarify the current state and identify the highest priority gaps.
Then you move to days 31 through 60, which is when you implement or pilot the single highest value improvement. You do not roll out the entire suite.
You just pick one piece.
Yes. You start with a feature small enough to complete quickly, but deeply integrated enough to expose the real-world operational risks. You essentially let a small subset of users try to break it.
And then days 61 through 90 are for reviewing the wreckage. You look at the results of that pilot, you document the lessons learned, and leadership has to make a hard decision. Like, do we continue, do we expand, or do we adjust the whole strategy?
It builds an off-ramp directly into the process. Leadership gains a practical, undeniable checkpoint.
Which is so rare.
It is. You measure progress with a mix of business, technical, and operational indicators that you chose before the project even began. Metrics like response time improvements, downtime reduction, or just user adoption rates.
Because if you don't pick them first, people cheat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You hold the vendor to the metrics established on day one, which prevents anyone from inventing a narrative of success after the fact just to save face.
Drawing the bullseye around wherever the arrow happens to land. It happens all the time. But let's say we've survived the vendor gauntlet. We found a partner with a brilliant 90-day plan. They passed the scorecard and they have an ironclad rollback strategy.
The dream scenario.
Right. But the source material pivots here with a pretty stark warning. Internal failures can be just as deadly to a software rollout as a bad vendor. We really have to look in the mirror.
It's so true. Even if you find a vendor who passes the rigorous 2026 scorecard, all of that effort is basically vaporized if your own house is out of order. A successful implementation requires a very strict internal ownership model.
Because the software doesn't just run itself.
Exactly. The best software in the world will lose all momentum right after the kickoff meeting if no one internally owns the day-to-day friction of actually implementing it.
So what are these roles?
Well, the guide identifies four essential internal roles that absolutely must be filled. First, you have the executive sponsor, whose primary job is to remove political blockers and basically secure the budget.
Okay, the money person.
Right. Second, the business owner, who defines the actual outcomes and ensures the software serve the overarching business goal. Third is the technical owner, who validates the back-end architecture and the security. And finally, the operational reviewer, who tests whether the tool actually functions in the day-to-day reality of the frontline employees.
The friction between these roles is sort of the entire point, isn't it?
It is by design.
Let's say the business owner, maybe the VP of marketing, they want a flashy new AI feature because it will make lead generation look amazing. But the technical owner, the IT director, looks at it and says, this feature requires exposing our proprietary client database to a third-party server. It's a massive security flaw.
That is the necessary tension this framework creates. The technical owner raises the red flag, then the executive sponsor has to step in, evaluate the risk versus the reward, and eventually break the tie.
And someone still has to test it.
Exactly. Whatever compromise they reach, the operational reviewer still has to test if the frontline staff can actually use it without slowing down their daily workflow.
But keeping in mind that this is a guide for mid-market companies, We aren't exactly talking about massive global enterprises with endless layers of personnel here.
This raises an important question. What happens in a mid-market company where these roles inevitably overlap? You might not have four different executives to assign to one project.
Plus, people are wearing multiple hats.
Constantly. The business owner and the executive sponsor might be the exact same stressed out vice president. The technical owner and the operational reviewer might be the same overworked IT manager.
The guide tackles this reality head on, actually. It notes that while the roles may overlap in a leaner company, the responsibilities themselves must remain highly distinct and visible.
You have to separate the functions in your head.
Even if you are wearing two hats, you have to consciously execute both functions. When you're evaluating a feature, you have to consciously ask, does this pass my technical security check? And then switch hats and ask, will my operations team actually click these buttons every day?
Mm.
If that internal ownership breaks down, the rollout blunders just start piling up fast.
Oh, they snowball. Rushing from executive approval directly to implementation without confirming upstream dependencies is a classic unforced error. Hmm. Teams get all excited, they get the budget approved, and they immediately start building, only to realize, you know, 3 weeks later that their legacy server can't even handle the API calls the new software requires.
Or skipping user acceptance testing entirely. That's a huge one. They just push the software live over the weekend and basically hope the staff figures it out by Monday morning.
Which never works out well.
Never. But the absolute worst blunder mentioned in the text, and this is just a nightmare scenario, is leaving old workflows running alongside the new ones.
Ah, the parallel system chaos.
It is absolutely devastating. Imagine rolling out a beautiful, expensive 2026 portal for your inventory management. Half of your team diligently logs in and uses it, but your veteran employees don't like the new interface.
Right, they resist the change.
And leadership never actually turned off access to the old system. So the veterans stubbornly continue running the entire warehouse off a massive, macro-heavy Excel spreadsheet from like 2018.
And the data never syncs.
Exactly. You are literally running two different companies at the exact same time, bleeding revenue through constant reconciliation errors.
Shutting off the old system requires immense internal discipline. It's why the first phase of the rollout must be kept so clear, measurable, and supportable. You have to prove the new system works so you can confidently, you know, burn the boats and turn the old one off.
Oh, going back.
Right. And protecting that fragile transition brings us to two elements that are so often ignored until it's way too late. Security and documentation.
Let's focus on security for a second, because treating it as a final checklist item in 2026 is just a recipe for disaster.
Security is no longer a feature you add at the end. It is the foundation of every single decision. It does not matter if the software is a client-facing financial portal or just an internal tool for the marketing team to share graphics.
Still have to protect it.
Leaders have to interrogate the mechanics. How is access authenticated? Where is the data physically residing? If an employee makes a change to a record, how is that change logged and audited?
Mm-hmm.
If a breach happens, what is the exact escalation path? You are always protecting credentials, customer information, and administrative privileges. A vendor who brushes off these questions is a vendor you walk away from immediately.
But even if your security is flawless, you still need a safety net for the relationship itself. Here's where it gets really interesting, because I look at documentation as a sort of corporate prenup.
A corporate prenup, that is the perfect way to frame it.
The source material makes it super clear that documentation is not just a wiki page someone scrambles to write the week before launch. Proper documentation produces decision notes explaining why a specific architecture was chosen.
It's the history of the project.
Right. It includes detailed system diagrams, access ownership records, and deep change histories created as you go. It is the clearest signal that you are working with a disciplined partner. But more importantly, the prenup protects your company when the honeymoon phase inevitably ends.
Good documentation is institutional memory. I mean, if your lead internal developer abruptly quits, or if the vendor's project manager gets reassigned, the project doesn't just grind to a halt. The new team can look at the architecture diagrams and immediately understand the mechanics of the system.
And it protects you from the nightmare of vendor lock-in. If a vendor relationship completely sours and they stop returning your calls, you really need that prenup to survive.
Oh, absolutely.
You need to know that you have data export options actually written into the contract. You need the administrative handoff steps documented. You need to know who actually owns the custom code. Without documentation, you don't own your business processes anymore. You're basically held hostage by the software you bought.
Exit readiness starts on day one.
Exactly. You have to know exactly how to get out before you agree to get in.
It is an incredibly sobering but empowering framework. You're taking control of the process from the very beginning.
So putting all of this together, what is the ultimate practical next step for you, the listener, if you are staring down a major technology decision this quarter?
The guide distills this massive process into a very clear, immediate action plan. First, completely document your current state. I mean, find the messy realities.
Confront the mess.
Yeah. Second, choose the single most important business outcome you need to achieve and firmly tie it to a metric. And third, create a short action plan that assigns those four internal roles, establishes a timeline, and sets your first 30-day measurable checkpoint.
Which shouldn't take forever, right?
No, that initial discovery review to identify your gaps and budget range, it should only take a disciplined team maybe 1 to 3 weeks.
And if your company is based in Southern California or Orange County, this is exactly the kind of heavy lifting Technigian provides. They offer focused consultations to help mid-market companies actually build these realistic phased roadmaps.
It's incredibly valuable to have that outside perspective.
Yeah, whether you need help scoping a security audit, figuring out a Microsoft 365 improvement, or just setting up a long-term managed service plan, they step in to translate your operational pain points into an actionable plan. You bring the business goal and the budget reality, and they help you slow down just enough to get the execution right the first time.
And if you're looking for even more resources...
Oh, right. The text smartly notes that if you want broader industry-standard context on project management frameworks or cloud architecture, checking out current guidance from PMI.org and cloud.google.com is an excellent supplemental step.
The entire philosophy here is about shifting from a passive buyer hoping for a good outcome to an active auditor demanding evidence. You connect the business impact directly to security, cost, and ongoing support.
It systematically neutralizes the dread we talked about at the top of the show. You replace the fear of a botched rollout with logic, evidence, and strict boundaries.
It absolutely does. And, you know, if we pull back and look at the core mechanics of this framework, starting with the outcome, demanding concrete evidence over flashy promises, assigning clear internal ownership, and demanding a strict 90-day checkpoint to review the reality of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
If this methodical outcome-first scorecard worked so flawlessly for buying custom software, what would happen if you applied this exact same strict scorecard to your own major life choices?
Oh, wow. I love that.
Think about how often we make a tool-first decision in our careers or personal lives. We chase a shiny new job title, a cross-country move, or a major lifestyle change without first defining the actual internal friction we are trying to resolve.
We buy the industrial pizza oven for our lives without knowing what we actually want to cook.
Exactly. If you wouldn't accept a vague scope of work, hidden long-term costs, and a total lack of a rollback plan from a corporate software vendor, why on earth would you accept those terms from yourself when making a massive life transition? Next time you are weighing a shiny new opportunity, demand the evidence, map your current state, and set a 90-day checkpoint to see if it's actually working.